You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. With President Trump's recent announcement of an entirely new branch of the military called the U.S. Space Force, the relationship between astrophysics and national defense has never been tighter. But my guest today points out that it's a relationship that goes back centuries and has played a key role in some of history's greatest conflicts and empires. And he says next time you use GPS or a microwave, you have the military astrophysicist to thank for it. So today I'm happy to welcome the smartest man I know, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, back to the podcast. He's an astrophysicist, the director of the Hayden Planetarium, a number one best-selling author, and the host of Star Talk. He recently co-authored a new book called Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military. And today he joins me on the podcast to talk about the long history of this mutually beneficial relationship between war makers and stargazers. He recalls his early qualms about the military space industrial complex, but says the military often serves as a source of creative inspiration for astrophysicists and shares some of the unexpected breakthroughs that emerged from government-funded defense projects. Then, Neil weighs in on President Trump's proposed Space Force and says just because Donald Trump suggested it doesn't make it a bad idea. In fact, Neil says he suggested the same idea years ago during the administration of George W. Bush, and he recommends that a space force shouldn't just protect America and our space assets from enemies, but from asteroids and space junk as well. Neil describes what a full-blown space war might look like and says it's nothing like what we see in Star Wars, but it could be just as devastating. So much so that he says there's a certain degree of mutually assured destruction to the militarization of space. Plus, a crazy scheme to weaponize asteroids, Neil suggests that America needs more than just a space force, we need a truth force, and we talk about the power of the words, I don't know. Coming up with the brilliant and fascinating Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson in just a moment. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist with the American Museum of Natural History, director of the world-famous Hayden Planetarium, host of the hit radio and TV show Star Talk, and the New York Times best-selling author of Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Now he's co-authored a new book called Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military. Neil, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, last time you came on the podcast to promote your previous book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry.
And look what happened to it. It became a number one bestseller. See what happened when I'm on your show?
Yeah, it just will. I don't want to take credit for that, but it will not budge off the New York Times bestseller list. How many weeks has it been now?
It's approaching 70 weeks, which is crazy. Most of the day I'm calm, but I'm really not calm. I mean, deep down inside, it's like, holy shit, what? I'm deeply reacting inside.
Yeah, I mean, it must be heartening for you that people are actually, in this day and age, are still that interested in science.
Yeah, precisely. In fact, my reaction is not even driven by the fact that I wrote it. It's driven by the fact that there has been a science book on the New York Times bestseller list for 70 weeks. And I happen to have written it, but it for me, it's hopeful, given the flow, the ebbs and flow of Trump books and celebrity books and all these things that have been populating the list. It has had a staying power that I think has defied most people, certainly my expectations.
Well, I wish you the same success with your latest offering, Accessory to War, which is a little bit of a more substantial read. I think this one has a good pound and a half on the last book.
Yeah, that's,
this is Astrophysics this book for People Not in a Hurry, right?
If you're not in a hurry. This is,
But nonetheless, it's worthwhile.
If you're not in a hurry, this is for you. Yeah.
Well, it's definitely worth reading. I couldn't put it down. And of course, it couldn't be more timely. You talk about the intersection of astrophysics and the military. I really enjoyed it. I was wondering if you've watched this new show, Strange Angel, about Jack Parsons yet.
No, I haven't.
Because so much of it reminds me of how Parsons just wanted to build a rocket to the moon, and the military was trying to win a war and create jet-propelled aircraft and missiles to win that war. But eventually, even though it happened after he passed away, we got both.
Yeah, and what you left out in announcing the name of the book is the subtitle, which for me is even more important than the title. So the book is Accessory to War, subtitled The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military.
Yes.
And that's where the meat and potatoes is within it, or the kale and carrots, whatever, if you happen to be vegetarian.
Now, that title, Accessory to War, almost sounds ominous. You know, I hear accessory and I think accessory to a crime or complicity in something nefarious, but you don't necessarily see this relationship in those terms. Would you call it a necessary evil, or is even that too harsh a term?
Yeah, I didn't know what word to use. Accessory makes it clear that You didn't really make the bomb. You know, you have the getaway car, right? you've enabled something to happen, even though you didn't do the thing itself. That's the sort of the closest word I could come to. Mm-hmm. But it's really a two-way street, and I don't mean to implicate blame. My intent was simply to say there are things the military does that, when it becomes declassified, we look over their fence and say, hey, we could use some of that. And then we take it and use it, and it enables us, empowers us to observe the universe more precisely or more deeply or more thoroughly. And then we, with our own scientific innovations in my field, have accomplished things that the military, looking over that same fence but back at us, says, hey, we want some of that. Now, of course, we can't tell them no. If we publish it, then it's everybody can know it and see it, and they just take it, right? That's just what they'll do. And this two-way street with the picket fence dividing the two lanes has been going on for centuries, even millennia. And the book is an attempt to highlight that for people who might not have otherwise thought this two-way street existed at all. And what might contribute to not knowing, It's a simple fact. That's why it's the unspoken alliance. It's not secret. It's just no one thinks to think about it.
Sure. Well, the contributions of astrophysics are all over the military, but it's not exactly like you can point to a specific weapon invented by an astrophysicist.
The physicist, we know, makes the bomb, right? And the chemist would make the napalm or the Agent Orange or the mustard gas, such as what was used in the First World War. And the biologist, if you're a rogue state, you might hire one to weaponize your anthrax. But the astrophysicist, there's no obvious connection between what we do and war or empire building. But when you look closely at it, you realize, oh my gosh, if you go far enough back in time, we are the ones who kept track of the sky, the night sky, the day sky, the sun, moon, and stars. And this is what you need to do if you're going to navigate the open ocean. And every naval power in the history of the world has had to tap the expertise of an astronomer who can tell you where you are on Earth, derived from information gleaned from the night sky. And, you know, the day sky, the night sky, depending on what, you know, the precision you needed for where you were headed. And so empire building could not have taken place without this kind of expertise shared with empires.
Right. And in a lot of ways, even today, one of astrophysicists' biggest contributions is still how they help us find our bearings, just with better technology.
This need to know where you are on Earth and where you're headed and where you're coming from continues. And today, the military accomplishes this. How? With satellites, space satellites. The GPS system was launched by the Air Force. The Air Force Space Command is what it's called. And this enables you to know with very high precision where you are on Earth, not only longitude and latitude, but altitude. And you get to know what time it is with high precision. And that's what you need for a command and control in a military operation, coordinating land, sea, and air. And so this kind of association with space, with the stars, with the science that drives my field is fundamental to so much of what goes on in the military. And that's what the book is about. I'm not telling you how to think about it. I'm not telling you if it's good or bad. I'm highlighting for you that it exists at all. And it's up to you, and you can judge it in whatever way you want. I'm not here to tell you how to feel. You know, pundits do that. Oh, you should not like this or vote for this person or not that person. No, it's not. I'm an educator, and I'm an academic educator, and I just want you to, whatever thoughts you have, it should be informed. And I dedicate the book to all those who ever wondered why astrophysicists have jobs at all.
And indeed, it does come back to astrophysicists because, you know, so much of the military technology being developed ends up being dual use and inevitably winds its way back into our daily lives, whether it's GPS or microwaves, you know, heck, preservatives in our food even started out as a military project. I mean, they're just thousands of everyday items that were originally created for the military.
Yeah, that's right. And some of them were more subtle, such as the ones you mentioned, and others are more bluntly obvious, like GPS, of course. And who would have thought that GPS, intended to assist the military in their operations, would then be the foundational principle on which Uber would be based?
Yeah.
Or Tinder. You know, you want to find your mate within 2 square miles. Tinder is using GPS satellites to localize that person. And so if the inventors of that technology knew, I don't know, maybe they'd chuckle.
Yeah.
I'll give you a couple of examples, again, in sort of recent decades. In the 1970s, there's an astrophysicist named Riccardo Jaconi, who was young and ambitious, and he knew that the telescopes we had trained on the night sky did not include the band of light found in X-rays. We had visible light telescopes by then. We had radio wave telescopes looking at objects in the universe that might give off primarily radio waves. And he wanted to see if anything in the universe was giving off X-rays. And so he pioneered an X-ray detector that could take digital data so that you could beam it back down to Earth. No, there were X-ray machines, like in your dentist office, but you'd have to put film in and develop the film, and then you had the film, and this is not conducive to launching into space, because X-ray telescope would need to be launched into space, because the X-rays are tampered by the ozone layer, so you can't have a ground-based X-ray telescope. So he works on this. Makes it small, miniaturizes it basically, so it's nice and portable, and it's effective. He launches the satellite, creates the first catalog of X-ray emitting objects ever.
Wow.
And that includes black holes, because matter swirling down into a black hole before it's gobbled forever radiates copiously in ultraviolet and X-rays. And so he had the first catalog of black holes. Meanwhile, these happen to be the years where hijacking airplanes to Cuba was on the rise.
Yeah, I
remember. And simple handheld weapons did this, all right? And Congress said, we've got to do something about this, and commanded the airports, working in tandem with airlines, to prevent guns from getting on board. And so do you now search everyone's luggage by hand? Do you pat everyone down? What do you do? And in comes this X-ray detector, and the name of the company that produced it was American Science and Engineering, and he's a co-founder of that company based in Boston. So they provided the first X-ray detectors for airports. And, of course, that's not war, but it's still security, right?
Yeah.
And that detector was made possible because someone cared about observing the universe.
So that technology wouldn't even exist, or at least it would have taken many years longer if it hadn't been for astrophysicists.
Now, in principle, it could have been invented otherwise, but it wasn't, right?
Yeah.
You know, so it just wasn't. Why are you going to invent a digital X-ray detector? Your film is doing you just fine in the dentist office, right? So what drives people to innovate and to invent is not always because you want to kill somebody, mm-hmm. right? And so this is an example of where the brain trust of astrophysicists has been tapped by the military. And one other one, again, a modern example, what do we care about in my field? A multispectral detection of dim things that are possibly moving across the sky and that are hard to detect. Well, that's exactly what the military cares about. And so whatever we innovate there, either in hardware or software detection techniques, they are right on the case.
So this cross-pollination fosters creative inspiration probably in a way that might not otherwise happen if, say, scientists and the military were just siloed in their own separate little worlds.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So part of it is just the ability for this information to be seen by the other parties. That's an important fact. Mm-hmm. There's another very recent example, well, last 20 years or so. I'm old enough to say that that's recent, okay? a 20-year-old college sophomore might feel differently, junior. That's before I was born, dude.
Time is relative.
Last couple of decades, the military, they had a longstanding challenge of how do you track a signal, a light signal, in the atmosphere where the light coming to you is disturbed by the differently moving pockets of air that are at different temperatures that refract the path of the light to land where you are in a place slightly different from where you think it is in the sky. Okay? So it's simply because of regular refraction. And remind people, refraction, if you take a pencil and you tilt it in a glass of water and you look at the boundary between the water and the air, the pencil looks like it's bent, right? That's refraction. The light rays are not coming from the same place when they hit you through the air or through the water. Mm-hmm. Well, in the atmosphere, that same effect will take place just by different pockets of air temperature will do this. So what you need to do is assure yourself you know where the actual thing is, because if you're going to shoot at it, you want to make sure the bullet is in the right place. You're not shooting some phantom image provided to you by its refraction.
Yeah.
So basically, the military pioneered an entire branch of observation called adaptive optics. Mm-hmm. Adaptive optics. And this is a system that compensates for this jiggling and wiggling of this image as it comes through the air. We didn't know anything about that until one day at one of our scientific conferences, someone who works in the military spoke of this new technique. And immediately we knew we want it, because our starlight is small and dim and it gets altered by these pockets of air convecting up and down in the atmosphere. And when we got a hold of that technology and perfected it, oh my gosh, we can now We greatly improved the precision and detection power of pre-existing telescopes. Forget new ones that would have it sort of built in from scratch. We add these to pre-existing telescopes, and you could double their power.
Wow.
Just by by this effect. And so
amazing.
So part of why you can double the power is if you take a long exposure, the star is basically wandering in the field of view, and it creates this smeared blob. But if it doesn't smear because you're compensating for that, it stays as a sharp point of light.
Mm-hmm.
And that greatly enhances your ability to decode what's going on in that object. And so again, these technologies move both ways across the divide.
Yeah.
Those are just recent examples. In the book, I go back to Galileo and Captain Cook and even Columbus. So it was quite the effort to compile the full history of this relationship. And that's why the book was so long and why it took so long to create.
Yeah, you spend a lot of time on the history of this relationship. How often has science and specifically astrophysics been a deciding factor in war throughout history?
Well, so when we think of deciding factors, typically we get stuck on who wins the battle.
Right.
Or who, okay. And it's a little more subtle
okay.
than that.
So it's more of a cog in the wheel.
Yeah, it's a cog in the wheel. But sometimes it's a really big cog in a really big wheel.
Right.
For example, astronomy buffs know, particularly amateur astronomers who own their telescopes and drag it out to their backyard or their rooftops, know that every couple of hundred years, the Earth and the planet Venus align in the solar system in such a way so that when you look at the sun, Venus moves exactly between you and the sun. So you see this black dot drift across the sun's surface. And the last time that happened was in 2004. Okay? But it doesn't, it doesn't happen in everyone's lifetime, right? Because the time intervals are long between when this happened. Well, before then, it happened for Captain Cook. So here's what happened. The British government said, Great Britain said, it's called a transit of Venus. They said, there's a transit of Venus that can only be seen in the South Pacific. This is in 1770, I think the year was. Only be seen in the South Pacific. Captain James Cook, we want you to go and measure the transit of Venus. Here's a telescope. Here's methods to measure it. And you will contribute to the canon of astronomical observations. Why? Because if you measure this carefully and accurately, you can figure out precise distances between planets in the solar system, between and among the planets. Before then, we knew relative distances. Okay, Mars is, twice the whatever, and Venus is two-thirds the Earth distance. So you had ratios and fractions. You didn't have actual measures of it. So he said, sure. So they outfit him with a ship and crew and tools to make this measurement. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, flip over this sheet of instructions. Oh, while you're there in the South Pacific, here are extra navigation tools we've been working on. Use these tools to map every coastline you come to and bring us back that information. So he does this. And he finds island chains, and he finds Australia and the coastline of New Zealand and what becomes the Cook Island. He maps all of this during his voyage to measure the transit of Venus. And he gets back, hands it over to the authorities. Within 18 years, Great Britain takes control of Australia. They take control of New Zealand. They take control of other islands that are there. And to this day, if you look at the flags of island states in that region, they all have little Union Jacks on them, the Great Britain flag on them as an insert square in addition to whatever else is their sort of sovereign symbols that they use.
Yeah, Australia,
New
Zealand.
All of them. Well, not all of them, but the ones that Captain Cook touched.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The Pitcairn Islands.
Oh, right.
And, of course, Tasmania.
Yeah.
And which technically is part of Australia, but they still have some sort of autonomy in that. He touched all of these. So it's not so much that a war was waged, but that an empire was built. And this is part of what enabled Great Britain to say the sun never sets on the British Empire.
Right.
Right? And there it is, using astronomical tools to measure coastlines and using an astronomical observation as the excuse to go there at all.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson when we come back in just a moment. Hey, folks, here's some advice for anyone who sends emails to their customers. You deserve a better email marketing platform, one that's actually designed with your type of organization in mind. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first, offering powerful email marketing with a personal touch. With Emma, you'll have everything you need to connect your data, build your audience, and do your most successful marketing ever. Because their easy-to-use platform makes advanced functionality accessible to everyone on your team, no technical skills required. You can even connect Emma with the services you count on to run your business, like Salesforce and Google Analytics. Not to mention, Emma's award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more. So put the power of email experts behind your marketing. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. Life can be stressful, and sometimes we lose perspective on what really matters. As we rush to achieve all the things we want in life, it can be easy to forget to enjoy the smaller moments along the way. But life isn't about following a common path or having a set plan. It's about being with friends, celebrating with loved ones, and living in the moment. Heineken believes that you create the richest memories when you embrace the unexpected and open yourself to new experiences. That's why Heineken encourages everyone to live spontaneously. Because when you embrace the unexpected, things like exploring new parties, enjoying the summertime, watching exciting soccer matches, and celebrating the holidays with your family, all become chances to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it up. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! Today I've been talking with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson about the science of astrophysics, but did you know that there's also a science to socks? That's right, sock science, and Bombas has perfected it. Thanks to 2 years of research and development and multiple improvements in design, performance, and comfort, Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. With an arch support system that provides extra support where you need it most, and a cushioned footbed that's reinforced for comfort without added bulkiness, Bombas feel like a hug around your foot. Not to mention, Bombas Stay Up technology ensures that your socks stay in place without leaving a mark. And the super soft cotton material makes you never want to take them off. So whether you're a runner, power walker, or power lounger, that's me, there's a pair of Bombas that'll add comfort to your life. As a matter of fact, I'm wearing a pair of purple Bombas Marl's calf-length socks even as we speak. They come in every color of the rainbow, and I ordered them all because they look great and they're easily the most comfortable socks I've ever owned. There's a good reason. These socks are scientifically engineered for comfort. Think about that. How much time do you spend trying to find a comfortable pair of shoes? Now ask yourself how much thought you've ever given to your socks. Socks go on your feet too, folks, and if you're suffering from tired feet, consider this. Maybe you've got the right shoes, but the wrong socks. You owe it to your feet to find out what a perfectly engineered sock feels like. Take it from me, they're a game changer. Go to bombas.com/kick and use the code KICK for 20% off your first order. That's Bombas, bombas.com/kick, code KICK, and you'll get 20% off your first order. Are you looking for expert coverage and analysis of the NFL this season? Look no further. NFL Podcasts has you covered. Interested in the latest news from around the league? The Around the NFL podcast crew has exclusive access to industry insiders and team personnel, allowing you, the listener, to feel in on all the action. Perhaps you'd like to hear more of your favorite analysts and players break things down on and off the field. Then don't miss out on the Dave Damashek football program, as Damashek and his guests operate on a strict no-jive policy. Only honest, unfiltered opinions allowed. Maybe you're more devoted than the average NFL fan? If so, be sure to catch the Move the Sticks podcast, hosted by former NFL scouts Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks. As the NFL preseason continues to heat up, make sure to follow along with NFL podcasts for bold predictions and insights into who will be the next big star. Subscribe now to Around the NFL, the Dave Dameshek Football Program, and Move the Sticks on your favorite podcast app or NFL.com. And now, back to the podcast. You open the book by talking about, I guess you were at a space conference at the start of the Second Gulf War, and I guess you had some reservations about the whole military-industrial space complex. How has your thinking changed on that over the years?
So I spend a lot of the first chapter having you participate in my coming of age. Mm-hmm. Right, because I grew up in New York City. It's a liberal voting environment. I remember the 60s, but I wasn't a participant in it. But I was, you know, I was awake and aware, and I watched the tides turn against the Vietnam War. And so that, for me, war was bad. Of course, you're killing people. Why else? Why are you doing this? So I could not understand why anyone would ever want to conduct any war at all. Yet when I walk around town, anywhere, you find war memorials, and more often than not, they show soldiers standing proud, brandishing some weapon of their era. You know, if it's not a sword, it's a musket, it's a carbine, it's something, and you walk by, and there's proud. We are proud of the, and I'm thinking, well, no one's proud of what's going on in Vietnam. So is it that my war that I grew up with was different than these other wars? Or did war really always have a different place in people's hearts? And so I was just confused, just completely confused. Fast forward in my life, and I joined the board of the Space Foundation, which is an organization that serves the interests of stakeholders in space access. And that would include military space, commercial space. That would be like DirecTV, anybody mm-hmm. who uses GPS satellites, yeah. The weather satellites, that sort of thing. Also scientific space. There's all these stakeholders, and it meets every year in a symposium. Well, in 2003, in April, we're all there. Oh, by the way, all the contractors to space come to this. We're all there, and what happens? The Second Gulf War breaks out, and the third day of the war was the first day of this conference, and many of the sessions were replaced with the live TV coverage from CNN, and you see these missiles get fired and the explosion in on the horizon, and the announcer never failed to, on CNN, never failed to say what kind of missile it was, and who manufactured the missile. This is a Boeing, blah, 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 and then Lockheed, blah, blah. And every time a company name got mentioned, the pack of people representing that company at the conference cheered. And I thought, oh, my gosh, are we at a football game or something, and there's a touchdown? Yeah. And I knew with every missile strike, there were people dying, being blown to bits. Mm-hmm. And I was deeply disturbed by this juxtaposition of the cheering and what I knew was happening at the other side of those weapons. And I, in my head, I said, I gotta resign from this board service. How do I explain this? And I gotta just walk out of the conference and not give my astrophysics talk that I'd planned to give. And I was like, but then I realized, wait a minute. These companies are serving the needs of the military. The military is run by civilians. The civilians who run it are elected officials that we vote for. And then I thought, okay, no, it is better that I see this than not see this, and know this than not know this, and feel this than not feel this. And so I stayed a part of that operation, just watching it unfold. And then I recognized that this is what it is, and it's something for me to possibly even document. And if you didn't know it is, I'm telling you it is. And then I'm share it with you. And I realize my people, my astrophysics community, that's when it came more real to me that my community historically has participated in this. Again, not as active makers of the bombs, but as facilitators of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I am not innocent in this, innocent of death. And that's when I went to the publisher, I said, I have to research this and write this up.
Well, Accessory to War is a pretty substantial achievement. How long did it take you to write this book?
The research for this book began in 2005.
Gosh.
Like 13 years ago.
Wow.
And that's why it's 600 freaking pages long. And and when I calculated how long it would take me to research and write this book, I said, this will take me about 1,000 years. So quickly I realized I needed a co-author. So I have a full, genuine co-author on this book, and her name is Avis Lang, longtime editor of my essays that I had written for Natural History Magazine. I wrote more than 100 essays for them between 1995 and 2005, 2006 probably. And we have a very good working relationship. She knows how I think and how I write. We've tussled over sentences and phrases and words, and we arrive at mutually agreed ways of expression, and she became the ideal co-author on this, and there she is, and even resisting publishers' urges to make my name twice as big on the cover as hers. You've seen this before. With enough arm twisting, I got them to just keep it a pure co-authorship, and that's what we've got there. In spite of many places I speak in first person in the book, it's just think of it still as a perfectly co-authored book.
Well, I guess it's a good thing that it took, 13 years for you to finally put this out, because it's coming out at the perfect time as President Trump announced the Space Force, this new branch of the military. And now you claim that you thought up that idea, I think, way back in 2001 or something?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, I can't have been the first to think about it.
Yeah.
But I do think about space. And I remembered in a commission that I was appointed to by George W. Bush. It was a commission to analyze or explore the health of the aerospace industry and make suggestions on what could improve its future. Mm-hmm. We were concerned at the time, the government was concerned, that is, the White House and Congress was concerned, that the aerospace industry was losing jobs at a staggering rate. It had lost, the industry had shrunk by 500,000 jobs.
Right, post-Cold War, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Then that's sort of the hidden one of the hidden forces operating on that. And there used to be many small companies that got bought or went out of business and got consumed. And at the time this commission was called, they were down to 5 companies. It's why so many of these companies have hyphenated names: Lockheed Martin, right? And there's Northrop Grumman.
Yeah.
Well, these hyphenated names were companies that had been other companies that all got merged. Anyhow. It's a commission of 12 members, people from the entire political spectrum, smart, educated, talented, accomplished people. And we're talking about space. And I just said to I put on the table, I said, has anyone considered spawning the Space Force off from the Air Force? Because the Air Force is the current agency that concerns itself with everything space.
Right.
In fact, there's something called Space Command. It's a literal title of a branch of the Air Force that has a 4-star general in charge of it. And so people were, they didn't jump at the idea, but they recognized that the Air Force, seemed to have it under control. And they didn't feel the need to spawn it off. And who am I to second guess what former generals are saying, former members of Congress, these are people who are sort of in the making of the sausage every day. And I was just this visitor to their world. So I said, okay, and we just moved on. And so the fact that Trump has suggested it, let me just first say that just because it came out of Trump's mouth doesn't mean it's a crazy idea. I just want to establish that right up front, okay? Doesn't mean it's a crazy idea. And this book, no, it wasn't timed to coincide with this. The book took 13 years to create. It's just coincidental that it's something to add to the dialogue that surrounds this book. What happens is if you create a space force, then you will separate from the Air Force all of the activities that focus on space and put them under the new umbrella. So most of this is just an accounting shift of activities.
Mm-hmm.
You might throw in a few new tasks. If that happened, I would suggest, why not throw in asteroid defense?
Yeah.
How about that? All right, that's not currently there. Or how about somebody's got to be in charge of cleaning up the space debris?
Sure.
All right, that makes commerce in space that much more dangerous with putting assets at risk.
Well, it makes sense because a metal bolt orbiting the Earth could disable a satellite as much as a deliberate attack, right?
Exactly, exactly. These pieces are moving at 18,000 miles an hour. So you might, if it is its own entity, you can imagine it being able to focus on problems in ways it couldn't have before because it has shared budgets with other needs, like do we have the next fighter jet? Are the monies lined up in place for that? So I don't have a horse in the race. If there's no Space Force or Space Force, I'm fine. But if there is a Space Force, I think it can be tuned in ways that can really serve some of the future needs that the country has.
Yeah, and speaking of protecting us from asteroids, I just have to say that there was one related anecdote in the book that I found rather amusing. Apparently, at one point, the Rand Corp was working on a project to weaponize asteroids. Now, that sounds like something Dr. Evil would come up or something. And it probably had a lot of unintended consequences. What happened there? Was it just completely impractical?
Well, no, so, I mean, with asteroids, there's so many of them. And there's the asteroid belt, just to remind you of sort of astronomy 101.
Mm-hmm.
You go from the Sun to Mercury, the innermost planet, then Venus, and then Earth, and then Mars. And then there's this big gap between Mars and Jupiter, long thought to just be empty until our telescopes improved and our detectors improved. And we would ultimately discover that there's stuff there, tiny, craggy chunks of rock. And we discovered a few, and so we discovered new planets. No, wait a minute, there's like dozens of them. Wait a minute, there's hundreds. Oh my gosh, it's a new swath of real estate that we never knew was populated. And that came to be known as the asteroid belt. And fine enough, but then we learned that not all the asteroids, the asteroid belt has 99% of the asteroids, but some small percent are wayward, and they have orbits that cross the orbit of the Earth. If you do the math on that, you will find that if an asteroid crosses the orbit of the Earth, it will eventually hit the Earth. It will eventually hit the Earth. So, well, an asteroid that hits Earth, oh my gosh, that happened 65 million years ago. Look what it did to the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
That was a big one the size of Mount Everest. But you can imagine a Dr. Evil-level plot to take asteroids and purposely make them hit the Earth. On command.
Mm-hmm.
And that with the built-in cosmic energy, kinetic energy they carry, you don't even have to accelerate it to those speeds. It already has it. You're just sort of directing them to your adversary. So yeah, that's definitely Dr. Evil.
So what happened to that Rand Corp project? It just wasn't practical?
It's not effective. Well no, let me say that differently. You could redirect asteroids, and it would do all the damage you think it would do. The problem is, you kind of have to wait till one is available and headed the right way,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to deflect it and wait for that to close out its orbit. And it's might not be the exact right asteroid to hit it might be too energetic or not energetic enough. Meanwhile, we have something called intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Right.
That you can launch at a target, and it gets there in 45 minutes.
Much easier and more accurate.
Much easier, more accurate, and it doesn't have the, it's not diabolically Dr. Evil in that sense, but it is way more potent a way more potent element of the military arsenal. You're never more than 45 minutes away from your target. And you don't have to wait for the orbit of an asteroid to line up for you. So, it was, you quickly put away the idea when you know you've got the missile silos locked and loaded.
So when we talk about space warfare, would it be that kind of death from above, lasers, nukes, and asteroids raining down on Earth? Or is it more about disabling each other's satellites and that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think most people's first thought is that you have like lasers coming out of space and people dropping bombs on your head. Again, the problem is, if that's how you wanted to do it, you'd have to wait for the satellite to be positioned over you in orbit. And maybe that position is not best aligned to do the damage you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we have intercontinental ballistic missiles, attacking Earth from space is not the most potent way to accomplish that goal. But space, as a repository of reconnaissance satellites, as a place where you're conducting business, there was a day where if you wanted to destabilize an economy, you might print counterfeit money and flood their marketplace and create inflation. And okay, how would you do that today? No, you don't print the counterfeit money. You just disable the banking satellites. Oh my gosh, now people don't have access to their money. People don't, I'm monitoring your troop movement with my satellites over there. I take out your satellite. Now I'm blind. Oh, I have all my troops knowing where they are because of the GPS coordinates. Just take out your GPS. Now I don't know where my troops are. So space warfare, if it were manifested, it seems to me, would not have anything to do with harming people, mm-hmm. not directly. It would have to do with harming the capacity of your enemy from doing harm to you.
And neither America or our enemies want to go back to the Stone Age, so is there a certain degree of mutually assured destruction to weaponizing space?
Well, yes, there is. Yes. And that's the famous Kessler effect. Everyone should know about the Kessler effect. I don't know that they called it that by name, but it was portrayed cinematically in the movie Gravity. If you destroy a satellite physically and it breaks into, 100 pieces, let's do a simple math calculation. I don't like your satellite, and I bust it into 10 pieces, okay? It'll go to more pieces than that, but let's just be simple. Now there are 10 projectiles moving 18,000 miles an hour in random directions. Oh my gosh, those 10 pieces hit 10 other satellites, busting them into 10 pieces. So now I previously had harmed only one satellite. Its debris harms 10 others. And then they kill 10 satellites each. Now I've harmed 100 satellites.
Yeah.
In another few rotational orbits, 1,000 satellites are taken out. In a matter of hours, you can completely destroy 100% of the satellites in your orbital zone.
Wow.
By that phenomenon.
Yeah.
That's a mutual assured destruction.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, you proposed, in addition to the Space Force, that we need a Truth Force, which I think you said in response to Rudy Giuliani.
On my Twitter stream.
Got a lot of flack from people on Twitter who were, they were saying that's an Orwellian idea, putting truth in the hands of the government and all that. Do you still stand by that proposal?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Because what I've noticed that the internet, it took me a while to mature to this state. The internet has no energy to see the positive things in what someone writes, and they will go out of their way to negify it, mm-hmm. Negativify it. I need a word there.
I think you just created one.
So, realizing that people viewed, by the way, the exact wording of the tweet were, I don't have a problem with the mm-hmm. Space Force, but what we really need is a Truth Force, one where the accuracy of information is held in high regard and is the tweet is more efficiently cut here. And the accuracy of information is defended against all enemies, foreign mm-hmm. and domestic. That was it. And everyone says, oh, this sounds like the Ministry of Truth. Well, ministries of truth in the propaganda sense are the opposite of accuracy of information.
Right.
So they ignored the two words accuracy of information in the tweet to then take that tack. And then I said, all right, let me add a second tweet to follow up. And I said, here's an example of the beginnings of a truth force, the National Academy of Sciences.
Okay.
It is a community of scientists who invoke the methods and tools of science to find out what is objectively true in the world. And this organization was chartered by Abraham Lincoln, a Republican, by the way, to serve the needs of laws and legislation in a country that was still kind of being born. And he recognized that advances in science can inform how you would govern. And so this is an independent agency that creates reports, that compiles the very latest and best scientific results on all manner of subjects, because the members of the National Academy of Sciences represent all fields of science. That's an example of a truth force. But no one wanted to think that way. They're trying to assume that a government elected official is going to say what is true and what is not. Of course that's not what I'm talking about. I'm a scientist. You think we're going to hand it over to politicians? Of course not. It's in reaction to the conduct of politicians. So I didn't lose sleep over the 10% of people that somehow thought that I'm saying we should elect officials to tell us what is true.
My only question is, does the Truth Force get guns and how's the pension plan?
No. The Truth Force shames those publicly who are trying to pull the wool over our eyes. Or more potently, the Truth Force, it trains you how to embrace the methods and tools of science so you know what science is and how and why it works. And when you do that, you can't propagate lies anymore because we're all too well equipped. We've been inoculated against it. That would be another example of a truth force.
Well, I did promise one person that I would ask you their question, and their question was, real quick before we go, how often do you utter the words, "I don't know," and what is your computer screensaver?
I say, "I don't know," anytime I don't know something.
Okay, that's fair.
And often, however, when I'm in public, people are asking questions that I do know, just as a scientist. But I can give you some good ones where my best answer is, "I don't know." You ready? Dr. Tyson, what is the nature of dark matter? I have no idea. Next question. Dr. Tyson, what is dark energy? I have no idea. Next question.
Right? No one knows.
But in those cases, it's not simply that I don't have an idea. It's that the entire scientific community has no idea. And as a PhD scientist, it's my job to know what is known and what is not known about this world, because that enables you to choose where to base your research. If it is known and I don't happen to know it, well, I better get my ass up there and learn it from those who did discover it. That's what I do. That's why I have 3,000 books on my shelf. That's why I write books that includes research that I hadn't been done before. It's what an academic does. Mm-hmm. I come from the breed of people who write wiki pages, right? They're not handed from Mount Olympus. They're people who are experts at things that actually write this stuff up.
And your computer screensaver?
my screensaver, let me see what it goes to. I'll do it now. Okay, screensaver is a rotating tiling of all the album covers of all the music that I own. So it's an iTunes screensaver.
That is not what I would have predicted at all. Okay.
That's the screensaver. But the desktop image, that's Van Gogh's Starry Night.
Oh, okay. Beautiful. Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, you are a very stable genius. And your book is called Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, thanks so much for talking with me.
Again, thanks for your interest.
Thanks again to Neil deGrasse Tyson for coming on the podcast. His book, Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military, is available starting Tuesday, September 11th on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. For more fun stuff, visit haydenplanetarium.org/Tyson, subscribe to his podcast, Star Talk, wherever you like to listen, and follow him on Twitter at Neil Tyson. You deserve a better email marketing platform. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first. It's powerful email marketing with a personal touch. Their award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more. So you'll have everything you need to do your best email marketing yet. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.